Hey, everybody, welcome back. Thank you very much for tuning in. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin, and I am back again with Dom. Dom, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am doing fantastic because we are once again back to talk some BB7. Always a treat when we get to do that, and particularly a treat today because with us is someone that I'm sure you guys all know and love from his work on The Tribe, The Survivor Historians, and then recently as the head writer on the RHAP B&B over on RHAP. Welcome to the podcast, Paul Osselson. Paul, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on. I'm so excited. This is the second time I think I ever actually get a podcast about Big Brother. So it's a huge, and thank you so much for inviting me onto the show.
No, absolutely. That podcast, I believe it was on RHAP maybe a year or two ago at this point. And I know that you, of course, are a Survivor historian. Are you a BB historian to the same extent or roughly the same extent?
A little bit so. I definitely with these older seasons, I didn't come in into the Big Brother game until season 2, but I definitely would say like seasons 3 through 10, 11, like I know pretty well. Like obviously there's a lot more content, many more hours that go into it, so it's not the same level of like regurgitation that I can do for the early Survivor seasons, but these early seasons of Big Brother were also very formative in my upbringing, so I hopefully will have something to say about this cast and the show.
Yeah, if you weren't watching Big Brother 1 live 24/7, then you're not a real Big Brother fan, Paul.
Right, I know. That's so nice. There's so many people that you could just like, you know, the Survivor community can be snobs about, you know, well, were you a day one-er or were you, you know, and I luckily was day one, so I don't even have to dispute that. But with Big Brother, it's like no one cares. It's like, oh yeah, season 2, that's fine, you're in.
Yeah, I was going to say, for me, I started with BB3 was actually the first season that I watched because I had heard so much about what Will Kirby did during BB2 but wasn't watching it when it was happening. And then it was like 2002, so I couldn't get caught up in any real way. There was no way even back then to like binge it on YouTube or CBS All Access or whatever. And like you, Paul, I would say my strongest knowledge of Big Brother is in that BB2 through, which I subsequently have watched and rewatched several times, through BB11-ish era, and then the more modern seasons, I really don't remember. I couldn't even pass a quiz at this point on like BB17, even something that recent, other than like I remember Vanessa Russo was on it and Steve won and Johnny Mack was hilarious and that was great. But it really is these early seasons that for me really brought me into the show and frankly have kept me watching the show even through the more recent seasons that I haven't loved nearly as much.
Oh, I was going to say maybe you hadn't rewatched these later seasons because they're just so pristine you don't want to taint them with a rewatch.
Yeah, that's
exactly my philosophy.
Right. Yeah.
I was going to say, Paul, it's interesting that you don't get that same kind of elitism with Big Brother fans because you would think it would be more likely with that. Because with Big Brother, you have these two different tiers of fandom. You can be someone who's there at the time, watching the live feeds, really engrossed in it, discussing it in the moment. And if you weren't one of those people, if you're just coming back to it 5 years later, you're not going to be watching the live feeds, you're just watching the episodes. You really can't get a sense of what it was like at the time, the same way you can where, like, maybe you don't get the same kind of mystique with some of the early Survivor seasons, but if I'm watching them now, I'm watching the same product that you were watching back then. It's not like we're watching two fundamentally different shows.
Well, yeah, and that's interesting about – so actually this season that we're podcasting about was my first time doing the live feeds, and I did it pretty seriously for about 3 years or so, and then it just kind of tapered off slowly and slowly after that. But for me, for some of these seasons, it very much was the experience I had watching the live feeds was one experience, and then rewatching it without those live feeds became another experience where now it's just kind of all blended together. It's been so long ago, but I think that's definitely one of the coolest things that Big Brother has about it when you go back to rewatch things is there is – all this other, you know, this well of knowledge and what was going on the live feeds that you obviously can't get really with other shows. So I'm very excited to jump in to talk about the season because I have very fond memories of the summer of 2006. It was my first time working. I was working at a Japanese restaurant, and I remember sometimes I'd work these split shifts. I had like 3 to 4 hours off in the afternoon. I would bring home my chicken teriyaki, and I would like plop down in front of the computer, you know, take a while for it to get going and get the live feeds really running, and I would be watching these all-stars. So a lot of fond memories of this season.
That's exactly how I remember like which what was sorry Don that's exactly how I remember that what year certain things happened, frankly, is what I was doing while watching Big Brother that summer, like what location I was in.
Yeah, I have zero memories of the summer 2006, and that's probably for the better. But I also have become accustomed to like thinking of the calendar in terms of reality TV, which maybe is a bad sign for me. But I don't know. It just seems like a lot of just events in life kind of correlate with, oh, I remember this season was airing at the time and I was feeling this way about this person because of this. And like that just seems so much more natural than like, oh, well, it was February the 22nd on 2015. Like that just doesn't have the same resonance.
Dom, well, yeah, totally.
Yeah, Dom, shame on me for either never asking this or probably having asked this before and just forgetting the answer. But I don't think I've asked it as we've been doing this podcast series. Dom, what is your origin story on getting into Big Brother? Because were you into it before you got into Survivor, or did you just hear about
it? Oh, no.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. And when I was getting into Survivor, I shied away from Big Brother because of the only frame of reference I had was BB UK, which is a complete garbage fire. and if that's what you're into, then it by all means embrace BB UK because it's perfect for that. But yeah, that kind of soured me on the thing. I didn't realize that the format was different, and at its best, the tone is a bit different too. But I think it was just that I was really getting engrossed in Survivor, and someone said, oh, well, Big Brother's kind of similar. It's a bit of a worse show, but maybe a bit of a better game. I gave it a try. I wasn't instantly hooked. I didn't go back and watch every single season the moment I had time, like I did with Survivor. But I gradually got caught up, skipped the season here and there, filled in the blanks eventually. But yeah, there's no real origin story there the way there is with Survivor.
What order did you watch in?
Oh, I don't even know now. I couldn't tell you.
Okay, I don't know if I don't think we've ever gotten into that on the air before. And I was wondering, did you ever dabble in BB UK at all? It sounds like no, but I don't know what you're into secretly.
Whoa.
What, me or Paul?
You, Dom.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I
just heard, I don't know what you're into, and I was like, whoa.
I remember having this discussion with a girl in my class when I was like 14 or 15, and she was saying that she watched Big Brother because it was really interesting to just see the people interact and just like what lessons you could learn from that. And I was just laughing in her face. And now, flash forward 10 years, or fast forward 10 years rather, and I'm now doing this as a hobby far more often than she probably thinks about any of this stuff combined. So
yeah,
I guess she had the last laugh there.
Paul, what international Big Brothers have you dipped your toes in?
Well, I actually was going to bring up this story here. It was actually during this time, I believe this is when Big Brother 7 UK was airing and the whole Nikki Graham's first show and all that. And I didn't – I mean, that was kind of at the time where you could just find – what did you refer to those times on YouTube as? The
Wild West?
The Wild West of YouTube, yes. I chuckled to myself as I heard that because that was so true. And so I would just kind of get – pieces of Big Brother UK just through YouTube. And actually I think it was a better viewing experience. I could just kind of watch the evictions and get kind of just like little snippets here and there. And it was like super intriguing to me. And so I definitely followed that and definitely the next season after that. But I mean, there's so much content on that BB UK. Like you can't even keep up with it. It's so much stuff. But I remember like following it pretty well for a couple of years. And I remember I met someone from England who was at college with me. And I was like, oh yeah, I watched. And I like try to like start a conversation about BB UK, and he was like, yeah, that's trash, and that kind of ended that conversation. So not too much on the international front for me.
Yeah, Paul, as kind of a get to know you, I suppose, as far as your Big Brother perspective is concerned, who have been some of your favorite players from Big Brother history?
Well, it's like so it was almost like you knew this and timed this, but like my number one favorite contestant of all time is hands down Danielle Reyes. So the fact that we're going to be diving into this.
Yeah, sorry.
Like, but I mean, really, it's like you knew. I mean, it's good and bad. I'm going to be excited to talk about that. But she by far is my favorite contestant. That's what I love about like a true all-star season. It's like such a shame that we don't really get them with CBS with a full all-star season, because that's really what shows you, for me anyway, like – that's kind of the test of who's like my ultimate favorite. Like you put them all up against each other and you see who's the one person you're really pulling for. So for me, Danielle has always been a favorite. And I don't know, like the thing with Big Brother is it's just like, because I wasn't there from the beginning and because the first season was so different than the other seasons and they just kind of make things up as it go, like, I don't get as bent out of shape about things like I do with Survivor. Like, I can get really worked up with how Survivor is going. So with Big Brother, it's just, it really is more on the entertainment side for me. I think there's so many interesting things that happen in the game, and it's a much more complex game that you can talk about. But for me, like, I definitely ended up, well, actually, embarrassing enough, I was more on Team Friendship during a season six, which that's pretty embarrassing to admit now that I was like really into Yvette, but then that kind of my loyalty switched over to Janelle. And then, gosh, I don't know, in these like later seasons, I just like, I didn't like Rachel Riley at all, but then by the time she came back, I found her super just like entertaining and stuff. So I and then obviously I have the appreciation for Dr. Will and what Chilltown does. I have the appreciation for everything that you know, Dan Giesling, Vanessa Russo, these types of players like that. So that's what I like in my Big Brother. I like a mix of some really strategic players and then obviously the ones that are entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, it's from that list, it sounds like some of the all-time great, like, strategic powerhouses, and then also Yvette. So I see, it seems like you did very similar taste to, I think, the same kind of appreciation for certain players that that Dom and I tend to like in the Big Brother house as well. So glad that we can get yet another white guy in here to talk some Big Brother with us from the exact same perspective.
With super, super basic, casual, views. I love Janelle. She's so fun. So sorry.
Yeah, I'm sure listeners of the Survivor Historians will know this already, but can you tell us what your reaction to Survivor All-Stars was, and why do you think the reception between Survivor All-Stars, at least the first edition, if you want to call it that, and Big Brother All-Stars was so different? Because now, looking back, I think most diehard Survivor fans really just skip over All-Stars. It's kind of like the thing that you don't talk about. You just kind of brush it, you kind of brush it under the carpet. Whereas Big Brother All-Stars, I think, is openly embraced by anyone who's ever watched it. Like, it is, I think it is widely regarded as one of the best Big Brother seasons and maybe one of the best reality TV seasons. I know that's both of our views.
Yes, no, and I agree. It's a fantastic season. And I actually, the era when I was not on Historians, when I was gallivanting around Europe and Mike Bloom was, taking my spot and then, using that spot to do everything he's doing now. I didn't get to talk about it that much in depth on Historians, but for me, I think Survivor All-Stars was just such an experiment that they didn't really know exactly how to cast a season of All-Stars. And so I just think all of those great players that just go out one after the other, after the other, after the other, and you're left with a final seven that's pretty underwhelming if you compare any of those people to their first seasons. So I think that this season on All-Stars, I think because it's a smaller pool, I think, Dom, you were the one who made the case that this season plays out kind of similarly, that we have these two people in the end who were probably the two people you'd cut from this cast. But I think it just plays out on such a smaller scale because the rest of the cast was so strong. It held up with all the other players on there. So for me, I think that the Survivor All-Stars was so much more of an experiment that didn't necessarily work, and this Big Brother experience did. But it's just ironic that Survivor now continues to do like these all-star seasons, but Big Brother like has never, taken the chance again to do it all. So I kind of wonder why. Like, what does Big Brother, was it the changing of the, the Shapiro era complete, or no, what's it? Was it Shapiro, right?
Yeah.
Up through seven?
Yeah.
I don't know if it was that changing of the, of who was running things, why they don't do it again. But it really kind of boggles my mind that they wouldn't try this again. Have you guys come to a theory on why they haven't risked it?
We've always thought that they just keep going to the people that would be future All-Stars too early because they want somewhere between one and four, or I guess it's six in the case of BB13, returnees in there, but also mixed in with a various amount of newbies. And in a situation where they could have just waited for, BB14 or whatever to roll around and put in the Donatos and Brenchel and Dan and have them all go at it against all of the people that ended up returning, it seems like they just were not willing to wait for the right caliber of people, I guess, to all be there at the right time. They seem to tend to want to strike while the iron is hot, I guess, so to speak, and really leverage that familiarity, I think, with the fan base as quickly as they possibly can. And that's why we see, I think, most people returning very soon after their first appearance in most cases.
Yeah.
And I do though think it's worth pointing out that BB7, the same way I think Survivor, like Heroes versus Villains, would probably be the exception for the Survivor All-Star seasons of people, of really big people making it to the end together, in the same way that we have, and we'll get into it very soon, we have Chilltown and Janelle and Danielle Reyes all still here at the final six, really warring with each other, the same way that Endgame and Heroes versus Villains had all of Russell and Parvati and Sandra, who, you know, these days, take this metric for what it's worth, but we're all like first ballot Survivor Hall of Famers, and I think with good reason. I do think, though, that the problem with just most All-Star seasons, whether it's Survivor or a fake Big Brother All-Star season, is going to be that the people who were the least impressive their first time around are going to have a massive advantage the second time around.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And I think that what Big Brother All-Stars does super well is even these people who are just kind of the fill-ins, like the Chicken Georges, like they provide enough entertainment in a way that they play their role. And, you know, Chicken George goes out right at the right time. Like, we don't have him in the final four, where in so many situations you have a character like Chicken George that's just kind of like drug all the way to the end. So I think that's another thing that the All-Star season has here with Big Brother, is that the couple people that maybe you're like, they all play a role in some way. Even Erica, who's someone who I'm not a fan of at all, especially for what she does this week. I mean, she's interesting enough that she's providing, she's kind of throwing this wrench into the game. So I just think it's like, it was just a perfect storm of how the season played out. So I can't wait to jump in and talk about this very exciting week of Big Brother.
Yeah, we're going to go today and talk through the final six and final five round. We have a double eviction episode here at the end of this. But before we dive into that, Paul, what were your just major takeaways from the season leading up to this point, like the season six domination early on to just collapse? Where were you on why, you know, as you were watching all of that go down, and just now, even in retrospect, on seeing how all of this early and middle game played out?
Well, you didn't ask me how upset I was that Yvette didn't get back in the house. That was very upsetting at the time. But I was also like, I was a huge Big Brother 5 fan. Like, for a long time, in my younger years, I would always cite Big Brother 5 as my favorite season. I don't think it holds up as well as it did back in the day, but I was really into the twin twist. I thought that was so cool. I was like so fascinated with Jace and even by Nokomis a little bit and Cowboy and all that. So, in the beginning, watching the season was a little bit rough, seeing the, you know, season 5 people just fizzle out, go out one by one. I can relate back to watching the first whatever 4 or 5 weeks, and just the Seasick Alliance and their dominance was like, it's an emotion that it's hard to like remember now watching, because you know eventually they're gonna like crumble. But I remember just watching that show, you're like, are they ever going to get taken down? So I think that it's massively entertaining having the alliance like that, and I just wish that Big Brother sometimes would have these longer stretches where things like this happen, because I think you get a lot of, like, you just see on the other side the way things that form and with the floaters and all these different dynamics, it just makes for a really compelling show. And one thing that you guys have talked a lot about is Will and Chilltown. Obviously, they're like the main storyline of the season, and obviously Janelle. But I really want to spend this week kind of thinking about Danielle, another really, really good player in the house, and I think she plays it so beautifully, despite kind of having a bumpy start in the beginning. So one of my biggest curiosities about Danielle is, like, what did she do wrong? Like, what could she have done better moving into this final six and eventually what happens this week? And then I also want to dive into Erica's game a lot and think, okay, was Erica's move, like, actually a good move for her, given the situation she was in? Because I've had so many like strong emotions about this. There was a long time where I didn't rewatch the season because I was so mad about this week. So that's one thing I really need you guys to help me with, is really to play out these two women and the games they've played, and really help me come to terms with what happened this week, what could have been done differently, what was the best move, and those types of things. Because I think this is just kind of like the you know, tipping point for the rest of the game. After this week, it's like pretty much smooth sailing now that at least one Chilltown member is going to win the game.
Right. It's will Janelle run the table in competitions from here, or won't she? And that's all that's going to disrupt someone from Chilltown from winning. And I definitely am excited to get into both of those questions with you about Danielle and Erica. And in thinking about just watching season six win these early HOHs, I hate it when I say HOH just because it's grammatically correct, but I sound like such a tool for doing it.
I hate it too.
I can't stand myself when I do that. Paul, the night that Danielle won that spiderweb competition, you must have been through the roof, right?
Oh, I you're telling the story, I think, when you were really rooting for like something like this to happen.
Yeah.
And I remember watching it on the live feeds, which as much as I got into the feeds, I could never really bring myself to sit there and watch the entire endurance competition because it was so long. This is one of the exceptions. I remember sitting and watching that and like jumping up and down, like so excited that finally Danielle won and finally she was going to take down, you know, the season six. Whether or not that ultimately is the best thing for Game Overall to win that competition and Erica to drop down, I'm not sure, but it was like, oh, that's one of the highlights of the season by far is that Black Widow moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into Danielle, who is obviously going to be the person who ends up leaving here at Final Six under what I'm going to call, you know, abnormal circumstances based on what you would have thought would happen when Erica wins this HOH. She's been Danielle's closest ally the whole time, and now James has just left the week before. Danielle seems to be a bit suspicious at this point that Chilltown might be no longer super looking out for her best interest. And she confronts Boogie about why James ended up leaving, and he seems to put it all on Will, like he didn't even necessarily know that Will was going to do that. But something's just not adding up for Danielle. You know, Janelle also voted to evict James, who ostensibly would have been like her best ally probably left in the house. And again, even though Erica is HOH, it does seem like the game is finally starting to turn on Danielle here. And I think, Paul, as we'll get into when we talk about like what Danielle might have done differently, I would probably say by this point, especially if Erica is even willing to put her up, it was already too late for Danielle. And I'm really not sure where if I'm going back to that spiderweb competition, I don't think I would do anything differently the week she was HOH. She just got unlucky, I think, that Janelle ended up being able to stay, which is obviously going to be a theme every time someone tries to nominate Janelle this season. But do you have any theories? I guess now is as good a time as any to get into, to this point, what Danielle could have done differently. Like, did she put too much faith in the Legion of Doom or not work well enough socially, you know, not develop good enough social bonds with the rest of the house, or what, like, didn't work hard enough with Chicken George or something like that?
Because the thing is, it's like it's heartbreaking to even hear you like talk about this again, because I do feel like she did everything right. She just ended up, you know, the pawns that were left in her hand at the end is Erica, who she thinks, like, she has no doubt about it. I think eventually she says this, you know, after she gets put up, she says, "Shame on me for trusting her." I think she really felt like Erica, it was that if Erica was playing the game wisely, she knew that Danielle had her back and the two of those two were super tight. So I don't know if Danielle could have done more to make sure that Erica knew that Danielle had every intention of going to the end with her and that they were, you know, going to take down Chilltown together or whatnot. But I mean, I feel like she just was positioned the best she could and she did everything. It was Chilltown. It was up against Chilltown and all of the, you know, people that, you know, keep getting added to this fake Chilltown alliance. And I just don't know. I don't know, when you get to the final six, you think, oh, Erica wins. It's good for, you know, Danielle should have won the final six challenge. I mean, I don't really know what else she could have done leading up to that final six.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It makes me think back to one of the HOHs, not HSOH, that Janelle won, where she could have just as easily thrown it to Marcellus and then, in all likelihood, I would imagine he would go for one of the Chilltown members, and the whole season just looks entirely different. And we talked during that week about just what remarkable shape I think Danielle Reyes in particular would have been in if either member of Chilltown had left sooner. And just every single thing seems to have broken Chilltown's way the entire season. Dom, do you have any theories about what Danielle could have done differently to this point?
I really don't. It's as you kind of alluded to, when Erica is willing to put it up, it almost doesn't matter if she actually does. The fact that she's even willing to consider it and willing to prioritize Chilltown over Danielle means that Danielle's game is effectively over, regardless of what Erica does with her HOH. And one of the biggest unanswered questions for me of the entire season is, let's say Danielle and James have been able to stick together and let's say they've gone after Chiltern earlier, what happens between the two of them in the end game? Does Daniel try to turn on James? Is James trying to turn on Danielle? And if that happens, who wins out there? Is it just who's able to do better in challenges and give themselves immunity? Because in that case, it's almost certainly James. But you can imagine that Danielle probably had better relationships in the house, certainly with Erica, or so it would seem. And I guess with Chicken George, because James really wasn't getting along too well with him. So I don't know. And I'm sad in a way that we never got to see that tension be resolved. But what we got instead was perfectly fine. So it's a good trade-off in my book.
Yeah. Let's then dive into how this whole week plays out. Because Danielle, after James has now left, is clearly on a mission to get Dr. Will out this week. And she thinks that this is going to be, this should be a relatively safe week for her. I would imagine she went in as soon as she saw Erica win, feeling like it would probably take pretty ridiculous circumstances for her to even be nominated at this point. But obviously that's going to get turned on its head. And we know that Janelle is going to be one of these nominations, assuming just any semblance of logic is going to come into play. Paul, I'm hoping a better memory, just better knowledge of how this actually played out, potentially beyond the TV episode, in terms of how Chicken George ended up being decided to be the second nominee here, because the episode portrayed it to just be a debate between which of Will or Danielle would be that person, and in the end, it's just kind of a twist where George ends up going up instead.
Yeah, I'm trying to think back to that. I just kind of felt like from my memory there, it just was a given. It was just like, okay, like this is the spot he's in. He's going to do it every time. And there was really no debate about that at all.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that folding out a little, playing out a little bit differently.
I don't. And it was just interesting to me that in rewatching this episode, typically they don't do this kind of thing on Big Brother, at least if as far as my memory serves, of blindsiding you with one of the people who gets nominated. Normally they're very straightforward about it's either going to be person A or maybe person B, but usually not. It's normally the person they're really hitting you over the head with. And in this case, I guess it's hard for Chicken George to come out of nowhere in some sense as a nominee. But I did think it was at least just an interesting way of editing the episode, and I didn't know if there was any kind of more potential backstory to why it ended up going that way, or maybe I don't know about what the timing was for the schedule, but they may have already known the POV results by the time they were piecing this together, and we're already setting it up for when it comes down to Will or Danielle the following episode.
Yeah, that very well could be the case with that. And I think I love when this episode starts out and it's like another indication of the great game that Danielle is playing and just how savvy of a player she is because very rarely do we get anyone in the season who like picks up on something that Will's saying, and Will's talking about so intentionally this whole episode how he really wants to remind people that he's responsible for everyone leaving the game, so that they're going to go to the jury and one, they're going to know that, he was pulling the strings, and two, people in the game are going to want to take him to the end because he's burned so many bridges. And I just love that that's kind of what, at least the way the episode portrays it, that's kind of what gets Danielle on this mission to get out Will, is that she picks up right away, okay, well, how would he be responsible for that? And she's really the one that's like, well, they must be controlling Janelle in all this. They must have a bigger say in Janelle's vote, otherwise he wouldn't say that. Of course, she's telling this to Erica and Chicken George, so, she's not really equal, think partners on this whole thing. So she kind of just has to, repeat it to herself over and over and over again.
Well, also, what is the alternative theory there? Like, there's really no other explanation. So as much as Will does his best to keep snowing Danielle over, even someone who isn't a player of Danielle's undeniable quality, I think would hopefully start to cotton on that maybe there's something amiss going on here.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's part of the answer of what Danielle could have done differently is once she does that math, and you're right, Paul, it is fun. You get to see it on the episode. They show Will at the beginning sitting on the couch bragging essentially about like, yeah, I guess you can give me the credit or the blame or whatever you want to call it for this James eviction. And then later they show Danielle doing the math of like, well, that must be exactly what he's talking about when he says that. It must mean that he convinced Janelle to make this happen. I think that what you may find fault in Danielle's approach here is not, especially when Erica wins the HOH right after that, hammering her as hard as you can all week long. Like, look, obviously Chilltown is working hand in hand with Janelle here. We have no choice. Like, it seems like, if anything, a great pitch to make to, if you're even remotely worried about the target falling back on you, this is as clear of an argument as one could probably put into her lap to say, look at Will almost bragging to us about the kind of control he has over Janelle. This is horrible news for us.
Right.
So actually, before we get into the rest of how all of this plays out, I want to talk about, this is one of the best food and luxury competitions and scenes of the season once they get the luxuries that they win here. But before we get into the Neil Patrick Harris of it all, Paul, I thought it was funny and so like indicative of what a change Big Brother has undergone over the last decade or so, where Will, for the first time, I think all season, has to dress up in like a wacky costume for one of the competitions. He's dressed up like a bee when they're doing this this food and luxury competition, and he gives a confessional about like, well, my medical career is over. Isn't this embarrassing? Me dressed up like a bee. In modern Big Brother, the people would love to only have to wear a bee outfit for like a week at a time, frankly. And they dress up in these crazy thematic outfits every single power of veto. I think it is so interesting to see just how stark of a difference the show has kind of undergone now that we are in, I think, like a completely different era of the show, where like, frankly, I feel like the game has almost become secondary to just making these giant cartoon characters out of the players.
Totally. And, you know, my brother and I, he watched all these early seasons very closely with me. And we always do this like impression of Alison Grodner, like just like totally made up. It'll be like, ha, oh, I love Will in that. I love him in that outfit. We need more of that. Bring him out. And we always like think that she finds like really, you know, things, these stupid costumes have to be so funny that she has to have it every single, you know, week. And there has to be this long thing. But I think you bring up a good point, because the other thing that I made note about in this episode is you could see, even just the way the show's presented and how they do these diary rooms, that, I mean, these episodes are goofy. They're goofy with Will. They're goofy with Mike. They're goofy with the competitions. But even their diary rooms feel way more like organic, and they're more like, it's more real the way they have people comment on each other. And during this challenge, when you have people like jumping on each other and squeezing stuff out of each other, and you really have these kind of funny diary rooms pieced together where they're commenting on it, it's just like so much more fun to watch than, you know, like, right, like if they were to do this, like, you know, this year, last year, whatever, they would have them like saying like these such fakey lines in the diary room where they'd be like, and then I look up and there was a bee on me and I was like, ah! And you just like, you're like, oh, shut up. Like, this was, it was goofy, but it was still like something that was real about it. It didn't feel like you were watching the scripted show.
Yeah, maybe Dom, can you give me an answer to this question? And because I don't want to be hyperbolic. I never want to be hyperbolic. I feel like, though, everyone on BB All-Stars was at least pretty good in the diary room. Dom, who was bad in the diary room on this season?
I think most of the people who, well, maybe not bad, but at least unremarkable, just left early enough that it wouldn't be an issue. So you can say maybe Nokomis, but then she was gone pretty quick. I mean, Diane was pretty good, so I was sad to see her leave. Like, there's really no, because you think of All-Stars in terms of their gameplay, their impact on the season. But part of their impact on the season is to the viewers on TV, and a big part of that, a big factor in there is how good they are in the diary room. And nowadays, even the good players, even the ones who feel at home both in the game and in the diary room, it feels somewhat contrived. It feels like they're just reading off a script or going through the motions. You don't get the same just spontaneity that you got back then. And maybe this is just nostalgia. Maybe if you know, maybe this is being unfair to modern Big Brother. Not that it really deserves any kind of credit in any respect, but I think everyone on this season could at least hold their own in the diary room, and that's all you can really ask for.
Yeah, Paul, we've talked about Will and Mike Boogie being, at least for the two of us, our all-time favorite diary room people. I will definitely say Danielle Reyes is high on that list as well, but I'm sure we were overlooking some people when having that conversation. Who jumps to mind for you as like the historically good diary room people?
I'm just thinking about, I think, like, for me, like, favorite Dire Room, all the people you named off here, obviously very, very good people, but I think in the early seasons you had some really classic characters that just really came through in the Dire Room. I think Marcellus was always wonderful in his Diary Rooms. I think Amy Cruz was, like, hilarious in her Diary Rooms. I think you look at season four, you had people like Allison and June who just were total, I'm not going to say the word. They were just ruthless in the Dive Room with how they I don't want someone. Yeah, don't at me, please. So for me, like, those historically really good Dive Room people are those, like, those people that could just be brutal and honest and funny and have good commentary on things in those early seasons. And I'm sorry, like, in current Big Brother, like, you just don't really get it that much. And obviously Brittany Haynes, like, she kind of. But she had it. She had a certain, like, you know, comedic presence about her that I feel like almost maybe during her era, it was like, okay, let's try to make people be as funny as Brittany Haynes all the time. And I feel like maybe that mentality is what changed these later seasons, where we have to make sure everyone's saying something super witty every time. Whereas in these older seasons, it's not that everything they say is funny. It's that they're being real, and a lot of things they say are funny because the show casts funny people.
Yeah, perhaps I think Brittany Haynes could have had something to do with it, but I think the person I would most attribute with the kind of shift in Diary Room focus, I think would be Rachel Riley, between BB12 and BB13, being so animated in the Diary Room and making everything like a double entendre and giving production exactly what they want constantly. I think, obviously by the end of it being one of the biggest characters in the show's history and being a winner, I really think that's what they started looking for in, like, everyone that they put on, is that kind of upside, to be, like I said earlier, almost like a real life cartoon character. And I don't know if, like, obviously that's not something that I personally am into, but it seems like that is at least what the audience, they seem to think the audience is responding to, because it feels like with each progressive season, we're just headed more and more in that direction. And I know, at least, I really don't want to be the people, I don't want to spend too much time just, like, bashing modern Big Brother, because I do know that it's got, obviously, a very devoted audience. Some might say too devoted of an audience. And yes. Plenty of people still find a lot of reason to enjoy it. But, like, I'm at the point, and I've said this on earlier podcasts, where, like, I don't think I'm going to be watching the next season of Big Brother. Like, I can't believe that this show that we're talking about, BB7, which I would frankly say is my favorite season of American reality TV ever, I can't imagine that relatively this soon after, I'm just completely done with the show, yet here we are.
Yeah, and I think this Diary Room discussion plays into this, that it just feels like in a lot of ways, it's just like the intellectual level of the show has just plummeted, and I think the Diary Room is a good representation of that. The fact that we have to have them narrating now in the Diary Room as if they're in the moment, as if, like, we wouldn't be able to, like, watch a challenge and then, you know, competition and then hear an analysis afterwards of how things went. No, we need someone telling us in the moment, oh my God, I have to win this thing. And, you know, and then they have these people that are, like, talking to the other people through the Diary Room, much like Colin, you and I talk through the B&B to communicate with one another. You know, they're using the Diary Room to say, so-and-so, what are you thinking right now? And it just, like, I don't know. I think it's representative of just kind of the show as a whole and the intellectual level where it's gone lately.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, let's get back to some of the great stuff from that was going on back in BB7. And so we were talking about that food and luxury competition where they won. They won plenty of food, but in exchange for some of the food, they gave that up for some fabulous prizes in the form of a backyard trampoline, a 5-star dinner, and Christmas in August, which it turns out is going to be hosted by Santa Neil Patrick Harris, who's going to make an appearance in the Big Brother house, who apparently Will was a giant fan of and was talking about constantly. So this seems very much like when they put in Tori Spelling on Adam Pock's season, where it almost felt like Will, like, requested Neil Patrick Harris, and they somehow came through. But this was great. I think, Paul, maybe this could be your next off-season Big Brother podcast, the best celebrity appearances in Big Brother. I feel like Neil Patrick Harris has got to be vying for the number one spot there, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, thank you for giving me more podcasting ideas. I think that actually would be a fantastic one. I think he's got to win it right away, especially just knowing the fame that, you know, has blown up with him since the show. I mean, it's right when How I Met Your Mother was getting going, and it was in its early seasons, and, you know, Will was really, you know, Will being smart, Dr. Will, you know, knew what a good show it would be and how popular it would be. So before we dive too much into Neil Patrick Harris, I want to say the two of you had a debate about the ugliest room that's ever been in Big Brother. You were debating these different ones. Okay, you forget here what a loss. They had to give up the red room, access to the red room, in order for them to, you know, win some reward during this challenge. That red room is the worst. It's with that huge bed, how there's not even individual beds. It's just like one huge ass mattress that like 15 people could be sleeping on.
I thought you were going to say Erica's flower HOH room. I'm sorry.
No. It's the red room. Like, not even, it's even Erica's is whatever. That ugly ass red room that luckily it was actually a reward for them to lose access to that. So, that's the headline you missed here as we move into seeing, Neil Patrick Harris come in the house and bring Christmas joy.
What a dark horse pick for ugliest room. That Erica flower HOH room is horrible too. They are really not on a good streak here with the HOH rooms. Yeah. But Neil Patrick Harris was a lot of fun. Will was a lot of fun. And actually, Paul, while you're giving a fire take about the Red Room, quickly let me say, at the time that Will was talking up How I Met Your Mother, he was right. It was a fantastic show for like the first three seasons. However, I have never in my life seen a TV show nosedive harder than How I Met Your Mother. It was completely phoned in from season four and beyond. And like any time that I see a show start off doing really well and then tank, I compare it to How I Met Your Mother. I call it a him-yum level meltdown when that happens to a show. So I just want to put that – I know it gets – it's another show that brings a lot of people a lot of joy, but that is how I've always felt about How I Met Your Mother, that it really gets a lot of – undue credit for anything beyond the first three seasons. But with that out of the way, I suppose we can move on. Unless, Paul, do you have anything else on the Neil Patrick Harris or this reward?
I think that I love little gems that really date the times. The fact that Janelle, she gives her list of things she wants for Christmas, one of them being a portable DVD player. So I think that's really fun. I also think that once Neil Patrick Harris does come into the house and they're all giddy and that's always really fun and stuff. Oh, yeah, this is going to be a good podcast because I also love the moment in BB3 when Sheryl Crow shows up in the backyard and they like kind of like, you know, run towards her and she kind of gets freaked out and stuff. But one of my other famous quotes from the Neil Patrick Harris visit is when he's kind of describing all the different contestants. And it's interesting how he describes Janelle as just having this presence. And then I love his description of Chicken George when he says, Chicken George, he's kind of simple. And then cut to a Chicken George opening up his shoes. Oh, they got a cool star on the bottom.
Yeah, Converses tend to have that, or whatever they were.
Right.
Yeah. No, he goes, Chicken George is kind of simple. And then they play the sound effect, ding, like, for the correct answer. It's really good. I would have definitely lost a bet. I thought Sheryl Crow was BB4. But apparently, I'm certainly not questioning you, Paul. I had misremembered.
Yes, don't go there with me. I'm right.
I'm sure you are. No, I wonder how many other things I've just like completely misremembered from early seasons of Big Brother and Survivor. But I guess that's what the Survivor historians are there for, to set me straight on. So yeah, with Neil Patrick Harris, very good stuff. Quite possibly the number one all-time celebrity Big Brother visit. We touched a little bit on the nominations earlier, but Dom, I'm curious what you think about if this was the right decision to put up. I think it's fair to say Janelle is a pretty obvious nominee, but Chicken George next to her. On one hand, I do think it makes sense for Erica. Like, she doesn't have the greatest relationship with Chicken George, it seems at this point, and she does have a good thing going with both Chilltown and Janelle. The issue, however, may be just leaving the vote in Chilltown's hands is always a risky proposition, especially when that's going to be the majority of the vote at this point. So where do you stand on these nominations?
Yeah, I will say quickly, Neil Patrick Harris, definitely the number one celebrity Big Brother visit. I don't know who the other candidates would be, and I think he will remain number one, regardless of who the cast of the actual celebrity Big Brother ends up being. as for this, you obviously want Janelle out this week, but then I don't know if you really have a good option for who else to put up, because if you put up one of Chilltown, you show your card. You show that you are onto them, that you're coming after them, and that you are part of Danielle's core alliance, if she still has one. And that makes it even more imperative for them to come after the two of you as and when they can. But then if you don't put them up, as you say, you're leaving the vote in their hands. You could also make the argument that regardless of who you put up now, the veto is overwhelmingly likely to either be used or be in the hands of either you and Danielle, so the two of you can use it if you want to. So I don't think that there's a bad option, but you could also look at it and say that, or rather, I don't think there's a good option, but you could flip that around and say, I don't know that she really has a bad choice either.
Yeah. And I think it is interesting, after we see these nominations go through, even now still with six people left in the game, Will is still saying in the diary room, I'd rather keep Janelle here over Chicken George. Like, he is relentless with this meat shield strategy of, like, as long as she is here, Chilltown will not be the priority. And we talked a little bit about this, I think, in our most recent BB7 podcast. But Paul, I just think it's incredible that it seems like it really took another, like, decade or so for both Survivor and Big Brother for this idea of propping these giant targets up in front of you and deliberately keeping them in the game for as long as possible being a really good plan. It felt for so long like everyone really bought into, like, the Boston Rob plan of, like, always take out the biggest threat no matter what as soon as possible.
No, I totally agree, and I remember there being many seasons where that was an argument that I would try to articulate, that, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world to go into the merge with someone with a bigger threat than you. It's not the worst idea in the world to keep a competition threat in the house. So it's kind of funny, like you said, it took so long, and now it's just like common knowledge. Like, well, of course you do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's all, you know, interestingly, Janelle also saying in her own diary rooms that she would be not going for Chilltown the following week, even if she ended up staying. So I think she was probably thinking something along the same lines at this point, or maybe just felt like she was out of options if Chilltown wasn't going to work with her. But she turns out would not need any real options. Because this power of veto is going to be yet another that Janelle is going to end up winning herself. It's the face mashup competition that I had completely forgotten existed. But this was, correct me if I'm wrong, this happened for many seasons in a row, right? Where they would take the people's photos from the diary room and then twist them up like they used to do on Conan back when he was on after Jay Leno, like mash the faces together and people would have to deduce who was where. And I feel like they stopped doing it because people started expecting it, and then everyone from like day one was studying the memory wall. Am I making that up, Paul?
No, that sounds absolutely accurate to me. And, you know, you think they stopped that. You think that maybe they'd mix up some of the other competitions in Modern Big Brother 2, that everyone just kind of figures out exactly what the competitions are going to be. But they started this in season 6, and that was like a really good challenge, and that they made kind of these, like, it wasn't like, yeah, they were like, you know, mix some people up together, and they were these really creepy. Actually, they started in 5, actually, because it was one of the twins won it. I think Adria won the challenge. And they had all these, like, you had Marvin saying these funny lines about how, you know, how scary, you know, he looks if he had a baby with Lori and all this stuff, and some really funny ones. But you could tell, so they did that for 5 and 6, and it was, like, really funny. Like, this one was pretty lame. This was just, like, highlighting certain, like, facial features, like, whose eye is this? And it's, like, isolated in one box with whose lip is this? Like, it was pretty dull. And then, you know, because this is Janelle's competition, because she won it, you know, 2 seasons back to back, she comes back on season 8 and hosts the one the week that Jessica and Eric go out. And it's the one where they're twirling around in Janelle's pink sofa, and the faces are all, like, mashed up, and it has to unwind itself, and they have to run over, and they're all dizzy, and they have to you know, go hit the buzzer and stuff. So this definitely is the lamest of the face challenges, but this was always a fun challenge, I thought.
If I'm remembering that BB8 competition correctly, they, like, go out to the yard and see the whole setup and, like, Janelle's photo, and Eric Stein just, like, roasts Janelle for a solid couple of minutes, and then Janelle pops out from around the corner. And he's like, he's so embarrassed, and it's hysterical.
I believe he calls her Miss Piggy, and then out she comes, and Dick says something about, like, oh, what a jackass, Eric.
Yeah, Dick known for watching his mouth and never saying a mean thing about anyone. Actually, Dick,
right.
Breaking news, banned from Twitter overnight, it seems. So that's a breaking Big Brother development.
Thank you for that update, Colin. Well, your actually, tweet was the one where I saw that.
Okay, further breaking news. Dick is back on Twitter. However, in the gap between recording this and releasing this, who knows how many times he will have been banned and then unbanned on Twitter again. So it's like Schrodinger's Twitter. It's unclear exactly whether Dick is banned at the moment, and looking only confirms it for you.
Yeah. Paul, I'm going to preface this question by saying this is tremendously unfair of me to ask you on the spot, but Janelle ends up winning this competition in 1 minute. Is this the fastest anyone has ever won a veto competition?
I mean, someone can fact check me on this. I don't recall anything being less than a minute. That was super, super impressive. Like, I love when Will breaks down the statistics of, like, percentages of how much faster she was than everyone else. And you kind of get this, you know, a Jerry from Baby Ted moment that he took, like, an hour to do something that Memphis took, you know, a few minutes to do. It's, like, the same type of thing here with Janelle taking 1 minute and Chicken George taking nearly 24.
Yeah, I think Chicken George took more time than the rest of the house combined.
Yeah, that was pretty pathetic.
Yeah. So Janelle, of course, ends up winning this power of veto yet again. And now we have this same dilemma that Erica was faced with during the nomination episode, except now the issue is a lot more pressing that either Danielle or one of the Chilltown members absolutely must go up on the block now that Janelle is coming down. And this is, of course, going to be a very tough decision for Erica that is going to shape the way the rest of this game ends up playing out. And we see the kind of back and forth there. And Paul, I'm sure this isn't going to be easy for you to talk about, but
it's rough. I'm getting so mad watching this, you guys.
Yeah, well, because the way the episode portrays it, she's going back and forth, and then it kind of cuts to Danielle seems to know you're about to go up. Like, Erica has just told her, you're almost definitely going up, and she is not handling it well, and she's trying to warn Chicken George in the hot tub together, like, hey, once I'm about to go up and I'm about to leave, when that happens, know that her allegiance is to Chilltown and you can't trust her and Janelle's all you got, essentially. And Danielle, understandably, in her defense, is not having a good night here. What happened to make Erica land on that decision, as far as you know?
Yeah, I'm trying to think back to exactly what happened. I don't know if she just told her or something, but, you know, Danielle had been drinking all this wine that they had, and, you know, that really is kind of what makes Danielle crazy in this episode. She really was drunk. She had been drinking a lot and was very upset after finding this out. And we see the scene where Erica tells her that, and Danielle walks away calmly. And then I think later on that night is when she really just kind of spins out of control and is so upset by the whole thing. But one thing that I think – this is jumping ahead a little bit here, but we can do that here because this isn't Survivor Historians. One thing that I do not think is fair of the show, the representation of how things go down, is they really seem like Danielle, once she goes up, that she's like totally buys in to the fact that she's not going to go home and that she like is fully convinced with them, when there were multiple conversations the whole time. Like, even from the minute she like knew that Erica was thinking about putting her up, she was like, I think she felt like her game was done or that she was in real danger. And when she was sitting on that block, same thing. I remember a very touching conversation she and Janelle had in the workout room, and Danielle like wishes her the luck, gives her some advice, gives her a hug and stuff. And it's kind of a really nice, you know, scene. That was one scene I wish they would have put on the show, because it was really nice to see these two giants like give a hug. And I don't know how, you know, how genuine or how superficial it was, but it was a nice moment to acknowledge that. And the show really kind of portrays that Danielle falls in line with everyone else and thinks that, oh, you know, Chilltown's got my back, so it doesn't matter no matter, you know, what happens here. So, but yeah, the whole lead up to the whole, you know, they were always called this online the Ding Dong Danny, I think is the what they would always call this whole moment. So rewatching, I mean, there's a lot I have to say about this Erica's decision. I want to, you know, discuss a few things here about, you know, Erica's move and all this. But one thing I was thinking about as this is happening, if Danielle thinks that she knows for sure she's that Erica's like putting her up and stuff, and I feel like she knows in this moment she's been manipulated, the decision is done, I think it's actually a good thing to do what she does, is to kind of go all extreme. I mean, maybe this is hindering her chances of somehow like making up some lie or really twisting things so that she stays off the block. But if she knows she's going up on the block, I think the more of a rivalry she creates with Erica, like from her game perspective, is a better mood because she's creating a conflict with another person in the house that's potentially someone that they're going to – if they're weighing out any options, that gives her us a glimmer of hope because she's setting up for someone else that I'm going to battle with again. She already has that. She's been going after Janelle all this time. If she's setting up that her target is also Erica, then that gives her us a sliver of a chance to stay in the game because yeah. I'm reflecting a lot on how should she react in that situation.
Yeah, I mean it's not a bad proposition to leave someone who's – going nuts on a person that's going to be in the house and can't play in the next HOH. Definitely not a bad proposition there. Let's talk a little bit though about this from Erica's perspective. I guess where do you want to dive into all of that, Paul? Because I'm sure.
Okay.
Yeah, go for it.
Yes. Okay. So a couple things that I want to dissect here with both of you and get your thoughts on it. One, so what I noticed from Erica's perspective is she kind of is all over the place with her reasoning for this. She says a couple times, she tells Will, oh yeah, and she's probably going to come after me next. So she hints at these things of, I can't trust Danielle. But then she also hints at that. She also then makes it clear that Danielle is the number one target. She will win this game. And that's kind of really the line that Chilltown's feeding her, that for sure, if Danielle gets to the end, she will beat you. You cannot beat her. No one can beat her. So one, I want to talk about those two things there. Like, if she really is making this decision on one of those two reasons, like, is that a really good decision? And then two, I want to talk about the frustrating fact that for all the credit we give Mike Boogie and Will for the game they play, Mike Boogie does not handle himself well in these situations when Erica, you know, really presses him, like, well, who's your number one? Who are you going with? Or maybe I should put up Will. And Boogie's like, no, yeah. not Will, not now. And the fact that it wasn't that Will and Boogie did such a good job of, you know, hiding their relationship to her or something, that you can't blame Erica for this decision. Erica knew. Erica had many chances to pick up on the fact that those two were inseparable. So I want to hear about Erica's decision from both of you.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. First of all, I definitely noticed when watching her asking Boogie right away when she's like, okay, so Will can go up and he can just go to the jury. And Boogie's like, no. We're like, we'll talk about that down the line, but that's not happening now. And then a couple of times they show her asking who his real number one is. And like, he's just not even willing to lie to her in that moment, which seems very unlike Mike Boogie. But I think that's because he feels like he can't lie and can't say that he would do anything other than take Will. It's so overtly true. And I think that's one thing that they did well early in the game is not at all try to disguise how obviously together they were. But later on in the game, I think that may have, if Erica was paying, maybe this is unfair to characterize it this way, but if she was paying more attention, I think maybe she would have seen that coming a bit more. The line I have always, I guess, convinced myself of is what you referenced, Paul, which is the Chilltown line of Danielle is going to beat you for sure in the end. And funnily enough, I think they frame it as like Danielle would beat anyone but Chicken George in the end, which is I feel bullshit and just some Chilltown propaganda. But I do think they're right about Danielle, that if she did find herself in front of a jury, she would be in really good shape. And I think that was what I have always thought was Erica's primary motivation. And I think Erica at some point maybe even says that was largely what her decision came down to. And maybe that was just TV magic, but I think she at some point says it was about who she thought she could beat in the end. Dom, do you have any take on that?
Yeah, the thing is, Erica's idea that Danielle would be coming after her next, it only makes sense if Erica herself is some kind of big threat, which in a house that contains Janelle, Chilltown, who I think individually are both bigger threats than Erica is, and as a unit, they're definitely a bigger threat. The only person that Erica seems to outrank in that regard is Chicken George, which is not really a high bar to clear. And I think George is the only person going back, I don't know, final seven, final eight maybe even, that Erica could actually beat in a jury vote. So unless Erica had this unrealistic picture of how her own game is being perceived, and maybe she does based on the way this round plays out and then also the jury questioning, that's the only way that can make sense to me. And of course, everyone is a hero of their own story. Everyone is delusional about just how good their chances would be. But it might be that kind of a misevaluation or misalignment that leads Erica to convince herself to do this when it seems like there are just much bigger priorities, namely Chilltown, who, if you let them stay in the game as a unit, are just going to completely screw you over. And I think this is the kind of move here which, if Erica pulls this off, if she goes after Danielle, she could possibly sell that as her crowning achievement. You know, if this is on her resume, going in front of a jury, this is the one move you can point to. But to do that, you really have to take ownership of that move. You have to be able to execute it properly and then sell it properly as well. And Erica really does neither of those. And I think this might be, on the contrary, this might be the move that really ultimately sinks her any chance she had of winning in the end. Because you now have Danielle, who I think was very well respected by the other players in the game, including by Chilltown. She is now the biggest advocate against Erica in the jury house. And Erica herself, and everyone gets to see this, she's just breaking down over it. She's tearful. She's not acting like this is just a move you make in Big Brother. She's acting like this is some deep personal crisis for her. And she has what I think is an amazingly insightful quote, which anyone who's going out there to play any kind of social game, whether it's Survivor or Big Brother, should take note of. She says, quote, "I'm an emotional person, therefore I'm an emotional player. I can't separate the two, unfortunately, but I took this decision very, very seriously, and it's just strategy." Now, there's a lot to unpack there, but note that even in the course of two sentences, like, there's this fundamental contradiction where she's saying, okay, I'm taking ownership of my decision-making process. I'm an emotional person, so that's how I make my moves. But then she also tries to disguise that or cover that up as if it's some, like, measured, serious strategic decision, which it can only be one or the other. That's a choice you have to make, and not making that choice means that no one is going to be happy with you, and that's what we end up seeing.
Right, and it seems like Danielle's overwhelming takeaway, when she was talking to Julie right afterwards, and I think it makes a ton of sense, was she kept saying, like, I wasn't coming after her, and especially if Danielle's going to be one of the more respected jurors, I think she's probably leaving the house feeling like Erica, who is framing this as I'm doing this for a strategic move, made a horrible strategic blunder in putting up a person who was indeed, of course, not coming after her. And it just brings me back to wonder how they even convinced Erica that Danielle might be coming after her next. Like, in what world would Danielle be coming after Erica next?
When Erica breaks the news to Danielle, she says something like, I cannot beat you in this game, Danielle. And that's true, but she also cannot beat Janelle or Will or Boogie, even, as it turns out. And when out of all those people, she chooses Danielle as her eventual target after Janelle wins the veto, it makes it look like she had to be tricked into doing that by someone else. Like, not only did she make a bad move, but it's a bad move that's based in arrogance about her own position. How arrogant do you have to be to think that Danielle is even coming after her? I think that's the prevailing attitude here. So it just sinks her entire game from multiple different fronts. It's really, for as much as we talk about Danielle having a bad week, because she is one of the most renowned players of all time, but one of the ultimate fan favorites, one of the icons of the show, Erica is almost easy to forget that Erica had a much worse week. You know, Danielle goes from having Danielle in the course of maybe 48, 72 hours goes from maybe be one of the favorites to win the game, like having James and Erica there with her, having Chilltown as this buffer maybe, to seeing James walk out the door, her best friend wins HOH, and then gets tricked or guilt-tripped or something into putting her up. So her game collapses, and that's a big fall from grace. Erica, I think, was already, as I said, drawing very thin to win the game, but this really is a nail in the coffin for any chances that she had.
I have two things I want to add. One, I think that I haven't, you know, I've backed off on giving Chilltown all the praise in the world because I feel like they needed one week where it was like we could be a little critical of them. But you have to give it to the fact that I think a huge part in this whole plan is that they have Janelle so wrapped around their finger that you have Janelle telling, you know, Erica, no, we can't put up Will. Will sucks. Will can't win anything. Will's horrible. He's pathetic. He's worse than Chicken George. So when you have also Janelle also completely on your side, I mean, think about what if they didn't have Janelle in such a good place? Then you'd have potentially Janelle and Danielle and Erica maybe, like, you know, going after Chilltown, and they could put that pressure on Erica to make a move like that. So I think you can't undervalue, you know, what Chilltown's able to do with Janelle. I think that plays out really big this week. And then and the second thing I want to say is that, let's be clear, the best move that Erica ever makes is getting Aris cast on Survivor. So not actually a Big Brother move.
I totally forgot about that. That's right. They were yoga buddies, right?
Yeah, I don't know exactly the connection, but I remember watching the live feeds and they were talking about, you know, Erica working for casting. And they asked, like, did you ever get anyone on the show? And she goes, yeah, the guy who just won. And she goes, what up, Ars Bushkauskas? And then it cut the feeds.
That's so awesome.
That's a memory I have very clear in my mind.
Yeah, actually, this week's old CBS shows that pop up in the lower third was going to be Survivor Cook Islands coming this fall to CBS. I thought that was hysterical.
I thought of you. I was so hoping there would be a funnier one to talk about, Colin. That's like my favorite segment on the show is is all the CBS. I have no idea if this was Big Brother or Survivor. You know, back when I used to have all these Survivors on VHSs that I watched, then you would really like see some of the old time advertisements that I'd have to like fast forward through to watch. And my favorite one is my brother and I always laughed about it. It was called Clubhouse. Do you recall?
I don't recall.
Okay, and it was you could look this up and see exactly what the deal on this was, but it was something about this like bat boy who like he's some for some famous baseball team. I don't know if it's the Yankees or what, or if it's, you know, an unnamed team, but like the whole promo of it is something happens and he says something about, well, should I go to jail or do I want the whole team to be mad at me? We're like, oh, what a dilemma. You should definitely go to jail for the team. You're like 16.
Yeah. No, I think my next BB7 rewatch needs to be those VHS tapes so I can get the true full experience with all the 2006 commercials. But yes. Paul, something you brought up that I definitely think we would be remiss in not having when we have a third party here in hopefully getting some kind of outside perspective on this. One thing I've just been self-conscious about as we've been doing all of these BB7 podcasts that I'm certainly aware is the case is we are both like unabashed Chilltown fanboys. I'm wondering if there have been points in rewatching the season or in hearing what we've said before where you felt like there was some criticism towards Chilltown that went unmentioned, that we could have done a better job, or that they could have done a better job, I suppose, that we didn't give them enough flack for, or something broke their way that we didn't take into consideration, or anything, any kind of just general counterpoints against them being god tier Big Brother players that we always, I think, kind of make them out to be.
Ooh, that's good. I should have been watching a little bit more carefully because I'm a big fan of the work they do. I think Will is great. Mike Boogie is good, but as you said from the beginning, you definitely did not give him a pass on this, but especially the fact that I watch the show a lot with my wife and my sister-in-law, it just like really comes clearer what a pig Mike Boogie is.
Yeah, that's so there's not like, great.
So it's like, it's really hard to get behind that, but I think this week in particular is the one that, you know, I'm glad that we're highlighting some of his not so great things is, you know, hiding his relationship with Will. Other than that, I mean, you got to give him credit for that HOH. Or when the Howie, you know, booth. I mean, that was really amazing the way that the coup d'etat is played. And then I'd be a little bit curious how much in the beginning for those first few weeks, how much is the fact that they're completely staying off the radar and making it through? How much of that? What factor did luck play in the fact that they were not targeted right initially? And how much, you know, of that can be contributed to the fact that they infiltrated right away? And, you know, obviously by week, you know, four, they really have, you know, they're pulling a lot of the strings with Janelle and stuff. But I just wonder about those first couple weeks, exactly what were the specific moves they made or the relationships they made that really kept them safe for those first 3 weeks?
Yeah, it may have just been like Kacer's general reluctance to be the one to draw first blood against them, and then season six running the table early on for, you know, the first month of the game may have been weirdly one of the best things that could have happened for them at the start of the game.
Right. I don't know if they actually, you know, if you don't, yeah, I don't know that it plays out the same way if you don't have season six winning all those challenges.
Yeah. So I think we can get back into just Danielle here, on her way out. And as you mentioned, the ding dong Danny scene, obviously not a good look. And I think of easily her worst episode in her Big Brother career, right? To go out on here in Big Brother 7, where she's you know, kind of yelling at Chicken George and Erica out in the hot tub. She's ringing the doorbell 800 times. I actually noticed, you have to look closely, but I believe, Paul, this is the only time in like 120 or so days in the Big Brother house we see Danielle Reyes smoking a cigarette outside. Like, that's how rattled she is on this night. And unfortunately, we don't get to see on the TV episode her having that good moment with Janelle on the couch. And while she does get to make like a very graceful exit and is, you know, super courteous with everyone, even though maybe some people had been lying to her the entire week, it does seem like Danielle here could have gone out in a better way, as far as I'm concerned. Paul, what did you make of just Danielle's exit episode here before we dive into Danielle in general?
You know, the pacing of it, I'm really glad that with the double eviction that we're going to talk about here in a minute, I'm glad that it's not drawn out too long in that in that eviction episode. I think that, yeah, I mean, she could have gone out in a better way as far as like leading up to the vote. I mean, at least it's dramatic, it's memorable. And I mean, the fact that she leaves the house with like such class and respect for the game, it makes the whole thing like, okay, you know, she went through this like really spiraling out of control, but at least it's, you know, at least then she comes around in the end. Well, and on that note, I'll say that I think this season, the reason why it's also so great, the pacing of it is perfect. It's the perfect length for a Big Brother season. It does not need to be longer. We have this double eviction coming up here. And then also, I think, you know, we only did this for a few seasons where we had the shortened weeks where, you know, they have to make an instant nomination. I've always been a big proponent of that and wish we would do some of that more than always having a double eviction. Because one, yes, you get the element of, oh my gosh, I have to put someone up on the spot. But then there is time to like rethink that decision. You saw in BB6 when Janelle does it and she nominates Maggie and Jen, and then later on she wins the POV. And you know, if that was a double eviction, she wouldn't have done anything. But in BB6, then she has time to think about it and revise things. She goes, "Oh, I actually think Yvette would be better to be up on the block instead of Maggie." And so you have time where you get the element of players need to make an instant reaction and they have to go with their gut. But then there is also time for things to change. I think it's a happy medium, and I think it moves along the show in a so much better way, because then for the next week you only have two episodes. You're not stretching out, you know, weeks worth of content into three episodes. It really isn't just two episodes, and then, you know, then the whole week starts over again. So I think that this season is just really well paced, that by the time, you know, we get to this eviction episode, we're going to be down to four.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. And just the general, not only just the game structure and so forth like that, but just the overall pace of this season, I think there's just not a slow week. Even the quieter weeks are still, there's always interesting stuff going on in the TV episodes. And just like, there's not, I would say there's not a bad episode of Big Brother 7 as far as I'm concerned. Whereas the bulk of, right, of episodes these days, yes, are just total filler.
I mean, it really is like the balance of, there's really interesting gameplay, really interesting people. I mean, even all their goofy set, like I was like found myself smiling at the poker scene this week when they're playing poker and with the M&Ms and George can't eat any of them because he's on slop. And, you know, Janelle's just winning them all. Like, they're fun. Like, they're not like people hide. OK, I don't want to bash everything.
That poker scene is perfect because Janelle, despite not understanding the rules and despite herself, ends up just winning easily. And anyone who has played poker with amateurs before and anyone who has watched Janelle on Big Brother could not be possibly surprised with how that turned out. Like, of course Janelle was going to win, and of course everyone else is going to get mad at her for it.
Yeah, that was a great scene. So just great moments like that. Like, you just – like, I feel like – it's like when you have faith in the contestants and you have faith in your casting and that you really put the work in there, then you don't need all the hoopla and the costumes and everything else. Like, it can be just organically fun because the premise of the show is interesting. I mean, obviously this concept of Big Brother works all over the world. Putting strangers in a house is inherently interesting.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with that. And just, on the concept of casting, I would say, as we kind of start talking a little bit, unfortunately, about kind of parting thoughts on Danielle Reyes at this point, my overwhelming takeaway every time I watch any of the seasons that she is on is it is infuriating to me that they have not, between Survivor and Big Brother, found more people like Danielle Reyes, like, I am reluctant to call them older women, but that's what they are by reality TV standards at this point, who really are tremendously capable players. It feels like it has to be deliberate that they are not putting more people who are as capable within either of those games as Danielle is, especially given how early they found such a home run in her and how popular she was. It blows my mind that they haven't been actively looking since the very early days of reality TV for a Danielle Reyes archetype. So that I think will always stand out to me is Danielle, I can't believe, hasn't been someone that they've spent the rest of the run of reality TV trying to replicate.
Yeah, this is where I jump in to point out, it is absolutely criminal that Sheila Kennedy has not played Big Brother again. That's all I have to say on the matter.
I think you need to say slightly more on the matter than that. Why is it absolutely criminal that Sheila Kennedy didn't play again?
Well, I agree.
Big Brother 9, I think we both agree, is misunderstood and maybe underrated season.
Yes, it's so good. Agree.
I say misunderstood.
It's so funny. I'm actually rewatching that right now with my sister-in-law who's never watched it before. We told her to like skip that one because we weren't sure. Like, we really wanted to get her into Big Brother, but we're like, I'm not sure if she can handle BB9. But now we're watching with her, and it's so funny.
Can I just say, only thing I will ever stake my claim on in when it comes to my place in the history of reality TV. I am the original Big Brother 9 defender. That is all. That is the only thing I care about my legacy being.
Good. I will defend it with you.
You're not even the Big Brother 9 hipster because there's not a movement around it yet. You need other hipsters that there with you to make that a real thing. I say misunderstood. I think it's pretty clear. Not in the right podcasting mentality at the moment, but bear with me. For me, like that season, I know we're both on board that Baller is an incredibly underrated TV character, and I would argue an underrated player as well. And now that he's out of jail, like we could potentially, we're not going to see him back, but it's at least in the realm of possibility. But that's the kind of season to me, which, like, if you can get past the fact that half of them at least are just awful, awful people, not just in the Big Brother house, but just as human beings, then there's a lot to enjoy about that season. Like, once you trim some of the fat early on, like, Baller's great, Sheila's great. I like Sharon. I don't know why, but she just seems really cool to me. There are just a bunch of really funny characters in there, and also some of the best all-time TV villains, in part because they are such awful human beings.
They're like IRL villains.
Yes,
they really are. Like high percentage of them locked up after the show. I wanted to say one thing before we like jump to that. I just want to say, you know, you went on your big run here, Colin, about not finding more Danielles. And I think I equate Danielle a lot to what Sandra was on Survivor. You have these two young moms who just have this like inherent knack for the game, but don't necessarily fit the stereotypes and archetypes they cast for. Danielle is not the black woman they cast on the show. That's just not she checks those boxes, but it's not that's not the kinds of people they look for. And same with Sandra, you can't put her into really the mom category or like they're such real people and so good at the game that they don't fit these traditional casting archetypes, but they're so good. Like, if we put more effort into finding these real people who are good at the game, who, you know, are not in it for the show business and all that stuff, like, you can really have some great TV. So huge Danielle fan.
Yeah, I think it's like Danielle, Sandra, Jean from Survivor Amazon, and that's the list. I think
I'm done. Click off the call. Done.
Yeah.
Those are fighting words.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I gather my impression is Danielle is among your favorite Big Brother players of all time, if not the clear number one, based on what you've said about her so far. Is she high on the list, even incorporating Survivor in that, or just where is Danielle like in your heart among all time reality TV players?
Yeah, she's got to be. I mean, she's up. I don't really have that list on the top of my head, but she's in the top for sure. I mean, if she's number one Big Brother, then she's one of my favorite of all time. And I've watched probably Big Brother 3 the most out of any other season. I think it's like such a fun season, and what she does in that season, it's just great. Like, she's just, you know, she's so many steps ahead of everyone else in the game, and she's a great player, and she's like so fun to watch, and she's great. So yeah, I have her up there.
I think Big Brother got so lucky to get both Will and Danielle in their first two real strategy game oriented seasons to really set the pace for what that show was going to be, because I think it could have been a totally different story without specifically those two people.
Yeah, very much like we look to Richard Hatch to the, you know, the kind of evolution, yes, of where Survivor eventually will go and what we will value about Survivor gameplay. Those two definitely, you know, we have the right next to each other, one who gets rewarded for that gameplay, and then the next season, you know, someone who doesn't, and that kind of sparks a lot of controversy. So yeah, they're very lucky they had those two great characters / players so early on.
Yeah, and I mean, looking even bigger picture than that, you know, Rob Cesternino always credits Danielle and Jason with being like his inspiration for being out there playing in the Amazon, which I think really triggered Survivor strategy into like the, you know, it really transitioned that into the next gear for sure. So I think she's partially responsible not only for the evolution of Big Brother, but also for Survivor as well. Dom, what are your just kind of parting thoughts on Danielle and her place in the reality TV pantheon?
Yeah, it shouldn't come as any surprise. I'm a massive fan of Danielle. I do wonder if we give her more credit in retrospect than maybe we should, because she didn't have the chance to lose to Jason. And so we remember her instead as this robbed goddess instead of someone who brought that upon herself. And going back to what I said about Danielle and James, I do wonder if it had come down to a clash between the two of them. Was James her Jason? Like, would she have this blind spot where even if it made sense for her to go after him at some point, would she just not want to pull the trigger on doing that? So I do think there are some questions there, but just as a character and as a player, like, Danielle is fantastic casting. Like, she is someone that she is a credit to the franchise, and it's a shame that we haven't seen more players in her mold. I do want to get your thoughts, especially Paul, on what do you think accounted for her different attitude this season, because coming into it for the first few weeks, and especially when she wins the first non-season 6 HOH and takes down Kesa, it looked like this was Danielle just taking her game to a whole new level. But then somewhere between then and this final 6 week, she almost devolves into like a Brenda from Kawamuran, and in Brenda's case she was checked out from day one, but Danielle, it seemed like she really let herself get overwhelmed by the emotion of the game. And she said in her exit interview with Julie, it was a lot more personal this time and a lot tougher. And do you think that's just, you know, change in her life situation? Was it something within the game that triggered that? What do you think can account for all of that?
I'll jump in here and say that I think, like, my impression of it, she walked away from her season and like got such a backlash from so many people about, you know, about how evil she was and like what a horrible person she was. And for someone who's a mom to come home to that, it kind of seemed like she wanted to prove she could play a game and that without that ugly side of things. So she makes it very intentional in the season that she, you know, is not going to do the kind of personal attacks and the way she kind of let herself talk about people in season 3. And so I don't know that her game changes that much, but I wonder if the fact that she's not allowing herself to express herself in the way that she did in season 3, to really kind of let it all out in the diary room. And obviously this season's a little bit different because you don't even have the jury, you know, the jury sequestered, but I felt it was more than just that. It was more about what, you know, the viewing audience is thinking of her and what just people's general perception of her would be. I think she wanted to prove she could play this game without being this nasty person. But I think maybe without that outlet of her just really being super real, that made it harder for her to really control her emotions in the game. So,
and this is like real Jerry Manthe style stuff, where like what Danielle was apparently taken to task for is so mild compared to what we have nowadays. Like, oh, she called Roddy the devil. How scandalous. Whereas if like nowadays it's full blown psychological warfare. If you're not telling people to fuck off and kill themselves in the diary room, then you're not doing it properly. Like it's really just a complete change of pace. And you almost wonder how someone like Danielle would adapt in the modern game. But if you place her in there, maybe she would be a fish out of water just because she isn't willing to debase herself in that way.
Yeah, it definitely would be interesting to see just like I have a hard time even conceptualizing Danielle in there with like a modern Big Brother cast where the average age is like 23 and a half. I really don't know if she would be in particularly good shape there. And I hate to say that about someone who I agree is like a historically talented Big Brother player. But I really do think the game is just so different now that it's hard to even fathom Danielle and that style of social game even being as nearly as effective as it was back in the day when it seemed like to me there were like I feel weird putting it in these terms, but it felt like they put quote like I understand the air quotes like implicitly around this, but it felt like they put like real people back on the show back in the day, and these days it just feels like I don't know, I can't even come up with a way of describing it, but it doesn't feel like they're even aiming for people that we're supposed to be relating to. Yeah,
No, I think
actually
that's
one.
a great point.
Yeah, sorry. One thing that I think is interesting to explore, and we touched on it a little earlier, but it didn't go into too much detail, is the idea of if it does come down to Danielle, James, and Erica potentially being able to get the jump on Chilltown there, how that end game plays out. Because I'm curious if either of you disagree with what I have my thoughts on that, which is just it seems to me like James would be viewed as the bigger threat out of those three, like the most likely to be targeted and voted out if it came down to any of those group being under the gun. I really feel like Danielle would be in like fantastic shape, couple not only between having James as like that meat shield there for her, but also having come up just short in her first season and feeling like the jury potentially feeling like we don't want to do Danielle Reyes wrong again, with that being the prevailing narrative coming out of BB3, and obviously being I think better liked in the house, frankly, than both James and Erica. It seems to me like that would be a tremendously favorable end game. And to go back to the question of like what she did wrong, I really don't know what there is to point at other than a couple of competitions falling differently to keep James in the house and make that the reality. Because I really do feel like she would be a pretty big favorite in that scenario, Paul. What do you think about how that might play out?
You make a great point there, especially because I remember in the early days of the feeds, there was so much discussion, a lot of it led by Will, talking about what a robbed, and I don't know if this is Will, kind of playing up Danielle as a bigger target in the game, but there was a lot of discussion of how robbed Danielle was and how she should have won. She's the best player that never won. And I remember at one point, like, then Marcellus kind of like freaks out and like, she screams and stuff about, he has to explain why they voted the way they voted and stuff. But there was a general consensus in the house that Danielle should have won that season. So I think that very well, up against an Erica or a James, I can definitely see that being, another reason to give Danielle the win.
Yeah, I also wonder if Danielle entered this season at somewhat of a disadvantage, the same way that I feel like Steven was almost at a disadvantage entering Survivor Second Chance, where I think they both almost went into the season feeling like I wouldn't do that much differently about the first time that I played. It just didn't end up breaking my way, whereas other people have a lot of mistakes from their first time to potentially learn from.
Well, that's an interesting parallel because I know that Stephen said that coming into Cambodia, there's this temptation when you lose in the finals your first time to just go all out, make these ballsy moves, and especially if you feel that the jury wasn't giving you enough credit, because if you lose because you played the best game and everyone knows it, but the jury is better, then whatever, you can play the same game and hope that you get more respect this time around. If you feel that the jury just didn't understand your game or didn't respect you or wasn't willing to give you a fair hearing, then you really want to make them do that. You want to play a game that is so flashy and so impressive that no one can justify not giving you their jury votes at the end. And you're going to do that, even if that means playing fast and loose with the other aspects of the game and playing in a way that's so risky that maybe you don't even get to the end to test that theory. Whereas Danielle, it felt like almost was on the same track at first, but then very quickly just faded into the background and didn't really do anything. And I think part of that was when you have this like season six behemoth in the house looking for its first target, you don't want that to be you. And it probably should be you, regardless of who it actually is. But anything you can do to lessen that perception is fine. But it really felt like Danielle was just taking more of a back seat. And it actually would have worked probably better, like you were saying. Like if she can set herself up with James and Erica, if one or two things go her way, I think Danielle is the overwhelming favorite to win the season, despite playing a very different type of game. And I'm not even sure how intentional that was on her part.
Well, I think early on, when she got nominated week one, she got potentially, I think, a bit gun shy. And I think she even got a diary room in like week two or three saying like, hey, I'm just here to hang out and not get on anyone's radar anytime soon. Like that was way too close for comfort. I'll get back to you in a couple weeks. And then she wins the spider web. Things look good. And the following week, Janelle wins HOH and Danielle is immediately under the hot seat. And I think potentially at that point, she started thinking, okay, this Legion of Doom thing seems good. And I'm going to ride that for the time being. And hopefully we can break off with James and Erica potentially down the line. And it just didn't end up falling that way. And I think that may have been just one issue for her in terms of timing was there were certain points where she felt like it was her best bet to lay low at spots where maybe it wasn't. Although I do feel like, to go back to the idea of Danielle like in jury votes, as it pertains to this season, I would say she would be certainly among the front runners just in the dark to maybe be the number one jury threat. Like, I think it would be close if she was somehow there against Will. I think it would be close if she was somehow there against Janelle. But I don't think those timelines are very realistic. I think anytime she's in the finals, she's probably against someone she has a good chance of beating in this cast. However, Paul, I really want to get your take on this. As Dom alluded to earlier, and I agree, we've talked about this many times before as it pertains to Danielle. It really seems like in Big Brother 3, her whole end game was tailored to go to the end with Jason, where she would lose to Jason. And we've also posited, granted based on much less, that I don't know if she even necessarily would have beaten Lisa had the jury been sequestered. Where do you stand on those two issues?
I mean, I think that's a very valid discussion, and it's like it's so hard, you know, to think back to then and know exactly how things would shake out. In a lot of ways, I think the way she loses, if you think that, okay, she has a strong chance to lose no matter who she's up against, the way she lost is the best way for her legacy, because you can point to, well, you know, maybe if these people wouldn't have been seeing all the things she was saying in it, then that would have an impact on her game. So I think it is, if she's gonna lose, it's the best way is how she did it here, or how she did it in season three. But I also think that something that, as people are leaving the show, and obviously things can change in the jury house, people can sway things, but people leaving the show were very high on Danielle. Kiara was very high on Danielle when she leaves the house. Amy's very high on Danielle. And it wasn't till they're, you know, out in the real world and they're seeing how Danielle is being perceived. So I think it is a lot up in the air of how that, what that jury house looks like and the dynamics in there, because a lot of those people were still walking out of the house still very much in favor of Danielle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, that definitely makes sense. I'm certainly, I hope it's never come across like we're stating with any kind of certainty either of those points about Jason or about potentially losing to Lisa in the end game. It's just, that's always, I've felt something that does not get brought up enough, and I'm glad to have someone outside of Dom and myself address that as well. And I think you are probably right that it's up in the air to at least some extent between she and Lisa if it does end up being a sequestered jury. Now, I'm actually almost surprised that we haven't seen Danielle end up playing down the line for like a third time, because I think she could have easily been that same kind of caliber player that like a Janelle or a Boogie that they would end up merits a spot for like a three-time situation, although I think that is probably out the window at this point. Paul, any closing thoughts on Danielle before we go to the rest of this double eviction?
I love her. She should play again. The end.
All right. Well, as mentioned, it is double eviction night, and this round is going to be a lot faster than the previous round, I would imagine. And I'm guessing we will have slightly less to say about this round's boot as well. But this veto comp, or I suppose, we have an HOH. It goes without saying, Janelle is your new HOH, of course. She wins the trivia competition. It's actually interesting because these days everyone is constantly studying what day certain things happened on. And even in a scenario where Big Brother knows people are aware of what competitions are coming and are adjusting based on what they expect. It really seems like they're never going to deviate from remember what happened when. And it is interesting to see Janelle being like the only person who was studying that this season. It's incredible, especially on an all-star season, to see that be the case. But I guess what are you going to do when the other people are Will and Chicken George and Mike Boogie? So Janelle is our new HOH. She ends up putting up Erica and Chicken George, and it is just ridiculous that the final two people left off the block are the two members of Chilltown. That just seems impossible. Like, if you were to say that at the start of the season, that Will and Mike Boogie would be the people that the final five HOH would want casting the votes, just seems absolutely mental, right, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, it's just at that point, you're just like, okay, they have, like, it's in those moments where, like, I always wonder about, okay, like, if I were ever on a show like that, and I'm like, who, like, someone needs to pinch these people, just like, just look at what happened. I don't care if you think you are the number one person, like, look around the room and the fact that these two people are sitting off the block, like, what is going on here? So, yeah. I mean, it's insane. It's insane.
It's wild. Just watching, it, to me, when it always stands out is, as people are walking from the eviction chair to the door, it's always Will and Mike Boogie, like, patting him on the back, like, you did great, hey, class act, leaving right here. And then the following week, they're blindsiding someone else and patting him on the back on their way out the door. It's just ridiculous. But Janelle is our final HOH. She leaves Chilltown off the block. And this is, as Dom and I have talked about before, this actually may be, like, our most talked about Big Brother Power of Veto competition, just that pops up in various other places of all time, because I think this might actually be the only HOH or POV competition that Will Kirby has ever tried to win, unless you can think of any others, Paul.
No, I think this is, oh, what was the, oh, I feel like there was, I don't know, I'm blanking on it and stuff, but yeah, that's what makes this competition, like, really fun to watch, just to see what happens when he actually tries to win and, you know, how he kind of breaks the rules and stuff. But I will also say a couple things about this. One, it's very fun to watch this, and it's funny, they don't call it, you know, a double eviction. They call it Big Brother Overdrive Fast Forward. It's like they're playing with some a few different, you know, names here for what they're going to call this thing. And I appreciate this challenge because if you're going to do a silly competition that's going to be over in 3 minutes on air, at least make like a specific skill you're going to do. Like, do not make people search through a ball pit for an object. Like, that is stupid. Like, this is actually like, okay, it's very simple, but at least there is some skill there and they're going to get it done within 5 minutes. So I think the challenge is solid. I think that Will's performance is super interesting to watch. And then a total upset in the end when Erica takes over with him. So it's just, I can't think of probably many other, you know, live veto competitions that can top this.
Yeah. This is like, if this was one third of a challenge on Survivor and it's just, they have to go through these giant knots and untangle themselves and then unclip their veto symbol and hit a buzzer, if this was just one part of a Survivor challenge, it would totally fit in on like any kind of John Kierhofer set. I think it's along those kind of lines, which you're right, is rare to see these days, especially on the live double evictions. And I think this POV, not just because Will is trying, but because Will comes very close to winning, as you mentioned, Paul. He starts out by breaking the rules where he just untangles enough of his rope and gets enough slack that he can hit his buzzer, but he doesn't unclip before he does it. And Dom, the reason that we have talked about this competition so many times is we have said if Will just unclips this veto properly and anyone, you know, he wins the veto, or frankly, if just anyone other than exactly Erica wins the veto, she leaves this round. She is not there to, you know, compare stories with Janelle the following week and get on the same page. It is very likely, barring Janelle running the table, that Will is a two-time Big Brother winner if he just unclips this veto properly.
Yeah, it's scary to think about, and it does make you wonder, how good would Will be in the competitions if he was just trying normally? Like, is he, because we see him and it's the smallest possible sample size because this is the only time he ever tries to win, but it seemed like he was doing pretty well for himself against two very solid competitors in Janelle and Erica, and a okay, I guess, competitor in Boogie. So I don't know, it feels like that is a side of his game which of course we never get to see, but maybe does have something to it. And yeah, you're right. Unless Chicken George is somehow able to step into the Erica role, which I can't even imagine what that would look like. Yeah, I think Janelle continues to be snowed over, and we go into a final three where, yeah, Boogie, I imagine, wins. Although you can make an argument that, like, I guess if George is there instead, then maybe something weird happens and Janelle doesn't take her hand off the thing in the first round, so then she goes through. But whatever. Like, I keeping everything else the same, Boogie wins, takes Will, and somehow, against all possible logic and common sense, we end up with Chilltown in the final two, winning another season of Big Brother, which would just be astounding.
Yeah. Yeah, totally wild. But nonetheless, Erica is going to win this power of veto here and save herself. Janelle ends up putting Mike Boogie up next to Chicken George, with Will and Erica being the votes. That is, of course, going to be going 2-0. Paul, don't let me see. Do you have notes from this live episode before we skip into just parting thoughts on Chicken George?
I mean, this is my notes here. I get pretty, like, I mean, it's the double eviction, so there's really not too much noteworthy in this. And I think it's like they're trying a lot of things out here. And I think this is like an example of, okay, you cannot just like just do this live and then expect you're just going to eavesdrop on these people talking. So there's a lot of like awkward, like they're trying to pick up the audio what people are saying, but you can't really hear. And so I think the better route is definitely the BB Can route on this, where it's not actually live. It's like an hour or two delayed or whatever it is, so that you can selectively pick a few little conversations to throw on the live show. But just, you know, actually eavesdropping on the house guests does not work very well in these live evictions.
Yeah. Are you, I know you mentioned just, being more a fan of like this, the timing of having it be instant nominations, but then just give them a couple more days to play an abbreviated round. I think the same way they did the first time through, where Chicken George had like a shorter half week HOH.
Right.
But are you someone who, when it is double eviction night on Modern Big Brother, back when I was a Modern Big Brother watcher, that would always be for me like the most exciting week of the season, because it honestly feels like these days that's the only time where you don't know what's going to happen. Where are you on just the double eviction episode?
I mean, I think they're a lot of fun. I think they should be used. I think that they need to be a little more creative with them. I think we can put them earlier in the game. I think that it's just a little bit too much. You get to a stretch of episodes where you know it's coming within these, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, and it's just like kind of the same thing. I feel like we need something new to freshen it up. I don't have that much of an issue with it. I don't think we need 2 or 3 of them a season. I think we need maybe 1, and then we play with the eviction schedule a little bit and have, you know, something a little bit different. But I agree with you. There's something that's inherently just fun about not knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess let's get into parting thoughts here on Chicken George, who, of course, our only representative from Big Brother 1. Paul, did you watch Big Brother 1?
No, I did not. And actually, before I will give my parting thoughts on him, but I did find one note I wanted to say here. When Janelle put up you know, this going back to the crazy decision of Janelle nominating, you know, not Chilltown. Do you guys love her acting job when she acts to be confused during the nomination process? She's like, oh God, I'm sorry. I haven't had time to think about this. So Erica and Chicken George, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I have to make nominations. Is that what HOH does? Sorry, this is only my fourth time. I don't know.
And it's like, compare that to the first time she wins, you know, HOH in a BB6, and she like, Janelle, please make your nominations now. And she just is like a total badass and just says, Jennifer, Maggie. And she just like slays, and now this time she's like, oh, I don't know what to do. But yes, Chicken George, you know, I'm like, I don't really think they had to have him. There was this big, it's like funny now to think about the fact that CBS would ever care now about having every season equally represented. That's like such a crazy thought now. So I do give the show a little bit of props of being, okay, we do need to acknowledge our first season. So it wasn't my favorite thing that he was in the house, but for someone who's going to be a non-entity, he was pretty damn entertaining. So you have to give him that. You have to give what a good sport he was about things. You have to admit he provided for that great week when he's HOH. So you can't complain about Chicken George being in the house. I think he was a fine addition to the house, and I'm glad he was not in the final four.
Yeah, not only his week as HOH, but also that week 3 power of veto where he shaved his head and went on slop for the whole season, really showing that he really wanted to be in there. Although I will say, that early on in this episode, they did flag up a couple of things he said in the diary room where it seemed like he was pretty ready to leave, where he said, like, you know, it feels like this is going to be the week that everyone's ready to just kind of take it slow and maybe I'll be the one who leaves now. And then later he was talking about, like, hey, Julie said, whenever I go, there's going to be fried chicken and beer out there for me, so I'm kind of looking forward to Thursday if it ends up being me. It turns out there was a real life Colonel Sanders impersonator there with some fried chicken and beer for George. But yeah, at the end of the season, very happy to have George out there. A lot of fun, and definitely bringing something that no one else really was to the show. Like, there were plenty of times where George went quiet, and that was fine. You're not going to miss him a whole lot, but when you do get a nice little shot of, you know, a scene of Chicken George inserted into every episode or two, it's always a lot of fun. Like, the belly flops with George this week were a lot of fun to kind of send him out. Dom, where are you at the end of the day on Chicken George?
My view hasn't changed. I love having him in there just as this undefined variable that no one can ever really pin down, because those moments that he does have, that he does gain power somehow, everything just collapses, and all of your best laid plans are ruined the moment the Chicken George gets to take control, because no one takes him seriously. Everyone just assumes, well, of course we can write off Chicken George. We can, we don't need to evict him. We don't have to take his vote seriously. He's not a threat within the game in any real aspect. So we can just write him off and pencil him in as a late eviction once everyone else is out of the way. And so when George comes out of nowhere, wins HOH, suddenly everyone has to think about what their role in the game is, how they can get inside his head, because he seems like someone who is going to listen to whoever's the last person in his ear. And I just love watching that. I love having someone who almost feels like they're playing a different game from everyone else while also playing the same game in parallel and really wanting to play it. As you said, that week three power of veto, you can tell he wants to be there. Even if he's not as renowned a player as anyone else in the house, he maybe wants it more than so many of them do.
Yeah, absolutely. So there goes Chicken George. A lot of fun having him on this season. We are down to four players. We have our final four now set. Chilltown still both in there, along with Janelle and Erica. Paul, that's going to wrap the episodes we're going to be talking about this week, but we are certainly not done with our coverage of it. But before we let you go, I certainly want to hear your thoughts on just how the season plays out from here and BB7 overall for you in, like, the pantheon of reality TV.
I was, once Danielle's gone, then it's like all my eggs were definitely in Janelle's basket. I wanted Janelle to win. I did not want the boys from Chilltown to actually pull it off. But if they did, I wanted it to be Will, to be a two-time winner, and he's fine and stuff like that. So the fact that Will and Janelle go out back-to-back was pretty upsetting for me. And so it kind of just ended on a note for me at the time. You know, going back to it, I can still very much appreciate it and really find, you know, rank the season high. And I think it's very, like, in a lot of ways, it's a satisfying end to know that Mike Boogie wins, knowing, you know, how much Will, what a role Will played on getting Boogie on the show and how much he wanted him to do this. The fact that Boogie wins, it's pretty much like another Will win. So it's kind of like Will, you know, did it. He did it twice. He got exactly what he wanted to. His big brother, best friend, won in the end. And seeing Erica lose was obviously satisfying, giving her, you know, what she did to Danielle and stuff. So I think it's a very fun finish. I love the moment when Janelle, you know, finally, you know, takes out Will and calls out Chilltown and does what she does. So there's a lot of fun to be had. I'll be excited to hear your guys' coverage. And then once it's all over, I recommend people to go onto YouTube and find this. I'm assuming it's still on YouTube. After the finale, Janelle, Erica, and Mike Boogie go on The View, and they sit down with Rosie O'Donnell and Elizabeth Filarski, now Hasselbeck, to talk about the finale of Big Brother. And it is so funny. If you at all have some, like, you know, some upset feelings with the kind of the piggish words and behaviors of Mike Boogie, especially once, you know, after Will goes, he really, like, really says some ugly stuff. It's just great because Rosie O'Donnell just, like, rips into him about stuff. And it's just, like, it's so funny. So I recommend anyone to find that on YouTube. It's a great, great watch, and it kind of makes you laugh in the end about how things turn out. So that would be my last recommendation to do.
I have not seen that, but I'm going to go find that as soon as we're done with this and definitely watch that tonight. Paul, thank you so much for coming on. You can, of course, hear Paul all the time on the Survivor Historians talking through all of the classic CBS Survivor seasons. You can follow him on Twitter, at Paul Osselson. Anything else you would like to plug at this time?
No, I think that's it. Survivor Historians, we were off for a little while now, and I think we're going to be gearing up for Samoa sometime soon. So it's kind of crazy to think about that Samoa is like about the halfway point of the Survivor franchise right about now. So I'm definitely excited to talk about, Russell Hance and everything that comes with him. So, you can find us on Survivor Historians, and thank you so much for having me on. I love talking about Big Brother, and I love talking about Danielle, even if it was her ouster week. So,
fantastic stuff. We definitely loved having you. And actually, in keeping with the Survivor Historians, we can announce joining us to talk through the final four through the end of the game, we're going to be replacing Paul with Mike Bloom. He's going to be on with us next time.
What else is new?
Mike is going to be joining us for that. So that should be a lot of fun. And then we will
change.
We will do one final wrap up podcast to close out the season on that. And afterwards, we will be moving on to some other season of old CBS reality. And you can help us decide. To find out more, go to patreon.com/Dom and Colin, because after BB7 is done, these are going to be patron only. So find out more right there, patreon.com/Dom and Colin. Thank you guys so much for listening today. Dom is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. You can email us, domandcolin@gmail.com. Dominic, anything else you would like to say before we get out of here?
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, I'm sure we will talk to you guys very soon. Take care, everybody.